I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. It seems to be a long time since I was sat in front of this microphone talking to you. I've been rushing about. And
yeah, it's an odd season.
Yes, forgive us. It's just strange.
It will get sorted out soon.
Oh yes, I'm not worried about it getting sorted out. It will. It's just I haven't really sort of... We hadn't done one for a little bit, and so we're doing some, and then there's another little gap, and then we're doing some more, and then we should all settle down. Anyway, I know what I've been doing. Mo, what have you been doing?
I've been working.
Betsy's been ill.
Betsy's very poorly.
Oh, poor old Betsy.
And hopefully she'll be okay. She had to have an operation, and now she's not very well. But it's hard with dogs, you know, because they can't tell you what's wrong and you can't force them to, you know, you have to, yeah, it's just tricky.
Yes, I can appreciate that.
When they get sick, you have to sort of go through a series of processes to work out, you know, sort of elimination.
Yeah. She looks a little sorry for herself, but she doesn't look absolutely dreadful.
Yeah. It's just because she's had stomach problems before, which was quite serious, and she had to have a major surgery for that. So I'm just worried it's that rather than something to do with the other operation. But yeah. I don't know yet.
You'll find out. You've got good vets.
I have a wonderful vet, yeah, but he does keep taking holiday, which he's totally entitled to do. I just wish it wasn't now.
I know the feeling. It's always wet. I've got some... My hearing's not getting any better, and I've got wax in one ear, so I'm going to have that electrically removed this week. And the other thing is I have to acknowledge the fact that I can't stop time and my hearing is beginning to go.
You need to go to the hearing specialist people.
So it's the onset of ageing is no joke.
No joke.
No. But I have reviewed the new Le Carré this week, the last Le Carré, which is wonderful. It's called Silver View, and it was his 26th and last full-length novel.
Wow.
I also reviewed the new Hillary Clinton and Louise Penny, thriller, which is very good. Better than Bill Clinton and James Patterson's.
Better than Bill's.
Yeah. Anything you can do, I can do better.
I mean, she is better than him, so.
Yes. So, you know, kind of... Yes, it's and I spent a lot of time in a car going around.
You just get driven to York?
Yeah.
How long did it take?
3 hours and a half.
Was it a comfy car?
What?
Was it a comfy car?
Oh, yeah. It's a BMW, big BMW with an extra sport.
Was it one of those ones with massages in the seats?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like those.
It's got massages. It's I haven't used fun. The massage in the seat yet. But the driver is excellent, very, very good indeed, ex-police driver, fully trained. So he's done hijack training and he's done fast pursuit training.
I'm sure
you've
asked him at length about all of that.
Yeah, oh, crikey. He's very good. He was also drove an armed response team, of which he was also a member. He's got the full the full Monty.
Full gamut.
Of stuff.
That's quite cool.
Very good, though. Boy, is he good. Poof.
It's quite funny to be sitting on these chairs with them not creaking.
It's funny, isn't it? Yes. Molly had the chairs repaired for my birthday, and they're much better. Much. I mean, they were dry. They were really giving way, but now they're almost artificially good. Sort of.
I'm sure that all of our regular listeners will be very used to the creaking noise. And it won't happen anymore.
No, it's a bit of a shock, isn't it?
It's a bit, yeah. Always sort of like a bit precarious, but now I feel very stable.
Good, well.
And well supported. They're very foamy.
They are. They're very foamy.
Anyway, we should probably get on with it instead of talking about foamy chairs.
Well, you know, give people a flavour of what's going on.
What are we doing this week?
The story this week is much requested by one of our most loyal listeners, Phil Brown.
Hey, Phil.
And he wanted us to do, and I was very happy to agree, which you might describe as the mystery of Gary Holton, which I intend to call Auf Wiedersehen, Gary.
Auf Wiedersehen, Gary. Okay, well, here we go with Auf Wiedersehen, Gary.
Gary Holton was born in South London. There's a slight disagreement whether it was Clapham or Lambeth, but it doesn't matter. On the 22nd of September 1953, he was a singer-songwriter, a rock star for a while, and an actor. But let's begin at the beginning. Gary Holton was the first child of Ernie and Joan Holton and grew up in Kennington. They were a perfectly ordinary family, happy for all accounts, but eventually, sadly, the parents divorced and Gary was mostly brought up in South London by his granny. He was a schoolboy musician and he was in a rock band at Beaufoy School in Lambeth. Now, that, by some extraordinary coincidence, led to him getting invited to be among a group of 30 boys who were invited to the Sadler's Wells Opera as obviously extras in performance. Well, he took to that like a duck to water. Absolutely took to it. And indeed stayed on while still at school with Sadler's Wells performing. Meant, of course, he earned quite a lot of money as a, you know, teenager. I mean, he didn't just stop there. He joined Sadler's Wells in 1964 at the age of 11 and stayed for 3 years till he was 14. In 1966, he got a part in Congreve's Love for Love with Laurence Olivier. And in 1967, he played the lead in Amal and the Night Visitors and joined the Old Vic Company and then went on to the Royal Shakespeare Company at Stratford. He was...
Oh, I didn't know that.
...a child star.
Hmm.
He made his screen debut in 1979 in a movie called The Knowledge. I think, from memory, was written by Maureen Lipman's husband, late husband. He got an uncredited role in the cult 70s film Quadrophenia about mods. He was also, in the meantime, Milky Bar Kid for a time, wearing a blonde wig. And he was in Hair for a time. He was a really precocious talent. Perhaps not the most balanced of young men, but nevertheless. But
what
precocious,
creatives are.
Precociously talented. But he also had a sort of parallel career in rock music. He was frontman for a band called Heavy Metal Kids, which was formed in 1972, when he was 19. And he became a very glamorous rock singer as well. I mean, he was discovered by Dave D of Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch and signed for Atlantic Records. Made their first album, which was well received but wasn't a massive seller. And then there was another album. And then there was an American tour in 75 when they amended their name to The Kids. Well, I suppose to get away from the heavy metal, I'm not sure. He did some success. He did a Top of the Pops. All sorts of... He had a bit of a rep. If you look him up, which I recommend as ever that you do, you can see this little pixie-like face, a rather sort of Ronnie Wood look. A kind of little pixie face and a bit of a cheeky chappy. But Heavy Metal Kids, or The Kids, whatever they ended up being, were finally broke up in 78 after they recorded an album called Kitsch. It was much of sort of a brief flaring of a career in rock. But at the same time, you know, he had been acting. So you've got this young man who is effectively really only known show business in one shape or form or another. He was remarkable. He was offered a role in EastEnders of Nasty Nick Cotton, but he turned it down, and it went to his friend John Altman, who actually succeeded him. They have metal kids for a while.
He was in EastEnders for ages.
Mm.
Nasty Nick.
Yeah.
Have you ever watched an episode of EastEnders?
No.
I didn't think you had.
I can honestly say I've never watched an episode. I haven't watched an episode of Coronation Street since 1960.
But and yet it's still going.
And yet it's still going. They could clearly survive without me. Mm. He had, as you might have expected, really rather a long series of relationships. I mean, in 1977, he dated a singer called Stella Palmer, with whom he recorded Something Stupid, a new version of Something Stupid in 1973. They got engaged, quotes, in March 77, but in May she called it off. He was just a naughty boy, really. There's no way of concealing the truth. But by this point, he was also dabbling in drugs and, of course, alcohol. But in 1979, he married a girl called a model called Donna Campbell. But they separated in 1981 after a couple of years, although, believe it or not, they were still married at the time of his death. So what you've got is a picture of this young man who's enjoyed really a lot of success. Maybe not the absolute pinnacle, but certainly on the upper slopes of show business. And he recorded again with another chap called Cass Steele from the Keys. And they had some success in Norway, and they, you know, like number one in Sweden. And it was quite a lot going on in his life. But I think it would be fair to say that he would call him troubled. After Donna, he was separated from Donna Campbell, he went out with another model. He liked pretty girls, called Susan Harrison, who gave birth to his son Red in 1983.
Same year as me.
Yeah. But at the time of his death, Gary was separated from Harrison and engaged to a hairdresser called Jeanette McElroy. Get it right? Jeanette McElroy. When the music started to die, he looked around again to see if he could pick up acting. And I happen to know, by sheer chance, the guys he went to work for and work with. The wonderful Dick Clement and Ian LaFrenet, writers, of course, of The Likely Lads and Porridge, and indeed, Alfreda Zane Pett. And Ian LaFrenet, the funnier of the two, although Dick is the brilliant organiser, I think. Jimmy was cast already, Jimmy and Alfreda Zane Pett being Jimmy Nail. But we had trouble finding Wayne Norris, who was supposed to be a rock and roll cockney.
Do you think you ought to explain to our listeners who aren't from the UK what Alfreda Zane Pett is?
Yes, I should, of course. Alfreda Zane Pett was a series of dramas, comedy dramas, written by Dick Clement and Ian LaFrenet, which really took the country by storm in the late 80s. I think they ended up making five series. It made the careers of Tim Spall and Kevin Whatley. It launched Jimmy Nail on an extraordinary ascension to the stars, but which is now rather tailed off. But it was a story of a group of workers leaving England because they couldn't get any work to go to Germany, mm-hmm. where they lived together in a hut.
I actually never watched it. Did it come out? In the 80s?
Anyway, by sheer chance, Ian LaFrenet, one of the two writers, meets Gary Holton at a party. After about 15 minutes, this is Ian himself saying, I made him swear to me he would call the casting agent. It was transformatory, really. I mean, talking about a massive hit. A hit comedy show, ITV. Made for Central Television in those days, but no longer. that just swept the nation. And there he was, this really playing himself, you know, Cockney, cheeky. He was known by Jimmy Nail in the series as London. It was that was his nickname in the hut in Germany. And he had, well, I think it would be fair to say, a stellar career. One of the things it did, at least according to legend, is in the wake of the first series of Auf Wiedersehen, Pet, Gary gave up heroin, which had been a problem for him. And indeed was contemplating founding a clinic to help people like him who had never really known anything solid in their lives. It was always starbursts. It wasn't calm. It was just always on the edge. And he was, you know, I think it troubled would be fair. You can find Auf Wiedersehen, Pet, I think, on the ITV Hub.
Really?
I think so.
Probably bits on YouTube.
But if not, certainly on YouTube. He was considering, as I say, setting up a clinic to help people like him who had this itinerant lifestyle. Unfortunately, too, how often have we talked about this? You know, particularly people in show business of one kind or another. He neglected to pay his tax.
Oh.
Never good. Ever a good idea.
Never good.
So he's got two bankruptcy notices out against him for $61,000, which is quite a lot.
It's a lot.
In the end of the 80s. And he has a massive mortgage on his flat he's bought in Maida Vale. And it's kind of, you can see it, you know, sort of sinking in debt. But never mind, he's got series two of Auf Wiedersehen, Pet coming up. But this time, they're not going to film in Germany because they burned the hut down at the end of the first series. This time they're going to work in Spain. Same cast, same characters, only they moved the locale. And you have to say that Gary Holton's career was on the rise. Really, really on the rise. And in a lot of ways, he represents one of the great mysteries of what you might laughingly call show business. Is it's very hard to handle early success. It's really hard. It does, whatever you think about it, it turns your head.
Yeah, it is. It's a tricky, tricky one.
It's very tricky. And he was, you know, to be fair to him, he was, very popular. Some of his music was very popular, for example. He got played a lot by on the Old Grey Whistle Test, the BBC series. German television, he was popular. You know, as I say, Norway, Sweden, Germany. And the Norwegian one with Castile they recorded four albums between 81 and 84. As the music began to fade away, so the acting came back, and he got really quite a lot of nice roles. He was the lead in a movie called Bloody Kids. And Ville says in his note to me, the more acting Gary did, the bigger the part seemed to get. He appeared in episodes of Shoestring, A Play for a Day, an episode of The Gentle Touch. But it was in 83 when he got the big break with Auf Wiedersehen. He played the carpenter, Wayne Winston Norris, who was also a bit of a ladies' man. Well, we can all agree that that would be pretty good casting. Then he made, when he finished series one, he started solo singles. He made a couple, Holiday Romance, which didn't do much, and then a remake, a rocked-up version of Catch a Falling Star, which led to Razzmatazz on television and an episode of Minder and Bullman. And he also turned up, believe it or not, in a West End musical called Pump Boys and Dinettes with Paul Jones of the Manfred Mann and Kiki D. I mean, he also made some ads for Tennant's Lager. You know, it was a kind of face around. So this time they go, but he goes back to Feed the Same Pat, second series in 85, which was first set in Wolverhampton, then Derbyshire, Newcastle, and then in Spain. It was about two-thirds way the way through the filming of series two that things did not start going well. Gary's ex-girlfriend sold a story to The Sun in October 1985. TV Gary's heroin secret. You can see the...
Yeah.
It's a real tab story. And so the next day, of course, there's he's doorstepped by the star. I don't think you could call that a pleasant experience. And so, of course, Gary reacts vigorously and attacks the journalists on his doorstep. So, of course, the star runs the place. Headline called Heroin Hoodlum, Star Men Attacked in the Street. it would be funny, but it actually turned out to be rather sad. And in fact, another double page spread, and the next day, the 24th of October, the Star had a tiny piece about Gary's estranged wife, Donna, wanting to help him. But there's no doubt that he was very stressed and he was very anxious. The final scene that Gary filmed with the other six actors in the series was in a pub in Newcastle, and that night, before Gary travelled back to London, he was found that very upset in his dressing room by Kevin Whatley, his co-star. Gary told them he'd been clean of drugs for a year. But he travelled back to London, went out to have a few drinks before going with his girlfriend, Jeanette, to a friend's flat in Wembley to spend the night. It's one of those mysteries. They go to bed. Janet goes to sleep. Gary goes to sleep. But when Janet wakes up the next morning, Gary's dead beside her in bed. The post-mortem suggested that he died of a combination of alcohol and morphine. And the pathologist at the inquest said he'd been drinking less than half an hour before his death, and the morphine would have made him unconscious within moments. The levels of morphine and alcohol in his blood were certainly enough to kill him. Well, there are all sorts of explanations for this. One is that there was only one fresh needle mark in Gary's arm. And so this is our listener Phil Brown's conclusion. I believe that he'd been clean of heroin for over a year, as he said he had to his friends on our feeder zone. Yet the next morning, those who were with Gary at that flat in Wembley said all that Gary didn't inject himself with heroin the night before, and no drugs paraphernalia like a needle or a tourniquet were found. Phil's explanation is that Gary was very stressed, and to get some respite, he took a shot of heroin, help him relax. And with being off it for so long, his tolerance had gone, and it proved fatal. Well, that leaves a number of unanswered questions, like where was the needle, and why did nobody see Gary take it? Well, there was a book written about Gary and his death. It was called... I get it absolutely right. Fast Living, Remembering the Real Gary Holton by Teddy Darling. She says in the book, it's some massive interviews I did. The mystery remains. The coroner was not convinced that it was suicide, and so recorded an open verdict, which means it could be reopened at any point should new evidence come tonight. I don't think I'm attributing any blame to anyone particularly. Perhaps it was simply the tabloid strain. There's no doubt that his friends thought that his death was unnecessary and that it was just a tragedy. And I'm inclined to agree with them that it was perhaps just one of those things. There can be no doubt at all that he was used to the fast lane, you know, and you could say perhaps even addicted to the fast lane. He'd had, given the fact he only died at the age of 32, he'd had a remarkable career.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
He's not the first celeb to die young.
No. The obits about him played up his hell-raising aspects. Lots of girls and three-way sex. And there's an awful lot of them. And Gary himself was quoted in one obit as saying, "I've been rich and I've thrown it away." The Mirror headline was "Drugs, Kinky Sex and Violence." And TV Wild Man.
That all feels a bit unfair.
I think it is a bit. But the phrase "three in a bed, love life" haunted him.
It's so... Yeah. I mean, do you think the tabloids were worse then than they are now? Or do you think they're just worse in a different way?
I think, to be honest. And it was... I mean, nowadays, I think people expect some kind of...
Also, everything's so much more exposed because of social media. Because of social media. Whereas you didn't have that back then.
This is a death.
We didn't have any internet or
anything. In 1985, we've got no internet. We've got nothing.
Different.
It would be completely different now.
Yeah.
But I think, and I think Phil's right here, it's a remarkably sad story. We don't know for sure what happened. We don't know what went on exactly. But we do know that he had talent. We do know that he was very likeable. We do know that he had a very interesting career. And all the other members of the cast, the star cast of Auf Wiedersehen, Pet, went to his funeral. His ashes were, if I recall, distributed in Welshpool in Wales, where his mum and dad were publicans. They divorced, but I think they reunited. It's quite complicated for me to know. But, you know, I suppose he was a tragedy of the entertainment industry. And we've seen a few of those, haven't we?
There are a lot of them.
You know, but it's a very interesting and really quite moving story. That it's the inquest is well documented. The pathologist's findings are well documented. There's no arguing about it was some, you know, something else. It's pretty clear. And was it an accident, or could he just not face it anymore? We truly don't honestly know. Hence the open verdict. But what is fascinating is that it's almost like a join up the dots of how not to deal with early success. If you look at the number of child stars who don't go on, it is astonishing. And there are legions of them.
Yeah.
Who had everything and then nothing.
Yeah. It's just necessarily it just is difficult to handle that and be handled through it also.
Yes. I mean, you would know about that because you look after actors. And you must.
I do not represent children.
No. No.
Because I don't like representing their parents, which is what you do when you represent children.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. That makes a very sensible decision. But, you know, what he didn't have anywhere in his life is someone solid.
Support. Steady support, yeah.
It was... If only he had someone to talk to. You know, to say, oh, I don't know, what am I doing? Is this right? What should I be doing? He had nobody.
Yeah, it's tricky.
And so he was just flailing about a lot of the time.
But also, when you're a child, if you're very successful when you're young, you can't necessarily trust the people who are giving you advice because they think that they can pull the wool over your eyes and they'll be the best guide for you.
Yeah.
But you can come out the other side of it. I would recommend listening to Billie Piper on Desert Island Discs. She's very interesting. She left home and lived on her own in London at 14.
Mm.
You know, and was like running through this mill and, yeah, got in a really bad way and then had to sort of like pull back from it all and like reinvent herself and, you know. But yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah. It's tough. It's tough. Yeah,
really tough.
And so I feel for Gary.
Me too.
I really do. Yeah. He had such a lot. And obviously such a lot of talent.
I mean.
And that show really was very significant.
Yeah, it was. Big time.
So that's Auf Wiedersehen, Gary.
Auf Wiedersehen, Gary. Thanks, Dad. Thanks, Phil, for suggesting it.
Yes, thank you, Phil.
Where are you off to this week, Dad?
Where am I off to this week? I'm going to Coventry tomorrow, Manchester on Monday, Brighton on Thursday, and then I think we've got Southampton the following weekend, and then Canterbury, and then Chester.
Gosh.
Mm, gosh would be the word.
How exciting.
You know, it's also somewhat daunting. I think I've finally begun to get used to it, but it is daunting.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you're doing a fab job.
Yeah. It's, because you see, we're not doing like a run. We're doing two performances and then on somewhere else. And so you don't really get in. You get into anywhere. Well, the moment you're in there, you're out.
Yeah.
You know,
you all will get in when you do the Pinter.
Yes. Well, when we come to London in January to play the Pinter Theatre in Panton Street, once called the Comedy Theatre, then we've got 3 weeks with all that
implies. A very old-fashioned London theatre, that one.
Yes.
If you book tickets, try not to sit in the stalls underneath the circle.
Mm.
Probably don't want to go further back than like G.
Okay.
A bit more. Okay. I don't know. I saw, last time I went there was to see, I think I saw some Pinter there actually. Well, you know when they did those three Pinters?
Yes.
Didn't David do one of those?
Might have done.
I think David did do one. My client Emma Naomi was in a Pinter there. But before that, I also saw they transferred Rob Ike's Hamlet starring Andrew Scott from the Almeida to there.
Yeah. The very talented Andrew Scott.
Oh, he's so great.
But, you know, I would call it the most massive learning curve.
Good to be on a learning curve at your age.
Yeah, I mean, I would call it from here. Sorry, I'm making a gesture rather than explaining it. It goes up like that. It's extraordinary. You know, don't forget to hit the light. Don't forget to talk to the circle. Don't, you know, all the things that you've... I regard myself as an amateur, but it's absolutely extraordinary.
Good work, Dad.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, that's. We should thank everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you to all the people that help us. Our producer, Sam Bray, my brother Dan, who did the music, my friend George, who drew a caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, to Jeffrey for all of his hard work, and to you, the listeners. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
And thank you for your patience with us with our wobbly season.
Yes, I do apologise. It's just simply that I'm a bit all over the place, literally. But we do appreciate you enormously. Very, very important to us. We would be lost without you.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very interested when we did Crime Con not long ago.
Gosh, yeah, it was so lovely to meet some of you.
Yes, it was an absolute delight.
And to meet the fellow podcasters of the UK true crime scene.
Yeah, it was absolutely fabulous. Really, really fun. So thank you again for listening. Thank you for bearing with us. It will settle down again, we promise faithfully. And as I often say, do be careful out there.